Hey guys, welcome back to Head in the Clouds, the podcast for real estate pros who are done with the burnout and ready to start working smarter, not harder. I'm your host, Heather, and today I am here with Tim Arrington. He is the owner and broker of Mortgage Core. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Heather. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing today?
Doing great. It's a beautiful day.
It is. It is a nice day. I'm glad it's not raining today. So today I kind of want to talk to you about your side of things. It's something that every real estate agent has to deal with if they're working with buyers and sellers, and that is mortgages. So let's dive into the mortgage industry, and who better to guide us than Tim. I have known Tim for several years, and he has handled several of my clients. I definitely trust him, and you've come in several times and saved the day, actually, when my clients had brought their own lender, and their lender couldn't get the job done.
Well, yeah, I love it when that happens, and we've done several transactions together, and I've always enjoyed working with you. You and I are in the same way. We're all about communication and doing what's best for the buyers.
Definitely. Definitely. And that's, you know, kind of a common theme in my podcast is relationships. That's what everything pretty much boils down to, is just the relationships you have with other agents, with lenders, your clients. It's a relationship business.
Exactly.
So, Tim, do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into the mortgage industry?
Sure. Yeah. So I've got a degree in industrial engineering, which is a far distance away from mortgages. But I did that for like the first 12 years of my career. I graduated with an industrial engineering degree from the University of Alabama. After 9/11, so it was like 1991, I believe, somebody said, hey, why don't you get in the mortgage industry? You can make some good money. And I said, I saw an ad in the paper and I responded to it. I thought I'd be doing it for maybe 6 months. And now I think I'm on my 26th year. So that was a little bit longer than 6 months.
But who better than to talk about mortgages? You have a very long, successful career of working with agents, working with borrowers. How has the industry changed for you since when you first started to like yesterday?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. It's night and day different. I mean, when we first got in, I don't think people realized we were in a declining rate market for about 15 to 20 years. I mean, from probably early 90s, all the way till just 2023, it was really in a declining rate market. So it's a whole different sale. You got people calling you, you know, it's a buyer's market, rates are going down. In the last 3 or 4 years, we all know that, you know, rates have gone up and it's a lot harder to attract buyers. It's a lot harder to convince people to do a cash out refi. So I think that's the biggest change, going from a declining rate market to an inclining, and just how you have to change as a loan officer, and then also as a real estate agent to attract business.
What in all of that is your favorite part? And then what is your not so favorite part?
Another good question. So my favorite part of the job, and it sounds a little corny, but it truly is helping people, helping buyers achieve the goal of home ownership, especially first time home buyers. You know, they don't understand the complexity of buying a home, especially on the lending side and also on the real estate side. But there's just a lot of rules and regulations and what is approvable and what cannot, you know, what we can use for documents. So helping people navigate the process to get to the closing table is what I enjoy. I like to kind of take control and say, you know, if you work with me, I'm going to tell you what's going to, you know, what documents you're going to need, help you get to the closing table. So the whole process is seamless. And at the end of the day, they're like, wow, this wasn't near as bad as I thought. So I enjoy that part, helping new people buy homes.
Is there a common misconception for people who are like first-time homeowners or want to be first-time homeowners that think that they can't get a loan, and in reality they can?
Yeah. I mean, there's some old misconceptions that are still out there, you know, like, well, I need 20% down. That's always a misconception. But as you know, I mean, we can go as low as 0% down, or we can do 3% down or 3.5% down. So the days of 20% down are really rare. You very rarely have a buyer now, just because it's so tough to save money, that has 20% down. There's some variation. And that's where I like to come in too, and not just be a numbers guy, but actually explain the process to them, explain what it takes, how it works. You know, you've heard this a million times, but it's the biggest decision, a financial decision a lot of people make in their lifetime, or one of them. And I really believe in informing them to the nth degree to have all the information. I'm old school in that aspect. I will prepare an itemized fee worksheet as many times as they want. If somebody says, hey, I want to go look at this house, I want to go look at this house, I'll run numbers. A lot of my competitors don't want to do that because they don't want their numbers out there that they can be shopped. It doesn't bother me because they're going to, I want them to know that I'm giving them a good deal, first of all, but also I want them to have the ability to shop around so they have all their questions answered.
You know,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say that's one of the great things I personally love about working with you is that relationship where when I'm out showing a house, I can text you, I can call you, I can say, hey, we need numbers for, you know, this subdivision, and we give you the taxes, we give you the HOA, and you can like on the spot give us numbers. If we're working, and I'm not going to say like a branch name, but if we're working with like a big bank, you have to dial 1-800 and then you get whoever answers the queue on the phone. They're not going to do that for you. You're not going to have that type of rapport with that person, especially if it's like Saturday at 7 o'clock at night.
I think that separates really the broker. And that's one of the things. I mean, there's three different, I think, avenues someone can go about getting a loan, probably more than three, but three main ones. There's banks, right? You know, maybe you have your deposit account with a big bank, and they also have somebody over on the side that says, hey, they'll help you with mortgages. And then it's kind of more of a 9-to-5 type position. I'm sure not all bankers are, but that's the general perception. And then you have retail lenders. So retail lenders they're selling their company's program and products only. And then the third, which is really rising in popularity, is the broker. And that's what I am. I've been all three. I've been with banks, I've been with retail lenders, and now I'm with a broker. I think broker gives the best overall experience, the best pricing, the best everything to the consumer.
What would you say to home buyers that are like, well, I want to use the bank that has my student loans? What would you say to them?
I'd say, yeah, I mean, by all means, get an estimate from them and then get an estimate from me. And I'll be glad to go over it with you line item by line item. And I can educate you on it. There was a misconception at one time that if you work with a broker, you lost control of the system and it took them longer to close, or you lost control of the file. But that's not the case. About 5 years ago, when some of the bigger broker players like Rocket and UWM invested a ton of money into technology, now brokers are actually, I think, quicker close times, and we have direct access to all the underwriters too. So I would say, you know, I would get, if I was about to buy a house and I was a first time homebuyer, even if I wasn't a first time homebuyer, I would get two or three quotes. I think that's enough. I wouldn't get much more than three. And I would truly compare apples and apples, because there's a lot of games that loan officers can play to make their numbers look little or less, but then that's not reality when you get to the closing table. For example, some loan officers may say, okay, we're only going to use 3 months of escrows, but they know that your escrows are going to be much more. Your taxes and insurance, your prepaids, they know that because they know when you're closing in the year. So that's a little stuff, or they may say the fees are going to be this, but then when you get the loan estimate, they're more. So I try to go over everything in a lot of detail.
When you have clients coming to you, and I know you could and you have done like whole seminars on the different types of loans, but how would you explain to a buyer coming to you the different type of loans that there are? And I know kind of like in a nutshell, because there's a lot to it, but if I'm a buyer and I want to buy a house, what options do I have?
Great. Another great question. So my first thing, if somebody says, hey, I want to get pre-approved for a loan, and I take the pre-approval process very seriously. And you, as a real estate agent, you really should deal with lenders that do the same, that take the pre-approval process. If somebody's just saying, I don't need any credit, I don't need any income, I'll just give you a pre-approval, you know it's a little suspect. You don't know how good that pre-approval is. Just kind of in a nutshell, that may help some of your listeners. What I normally do is say, hey, do you have an idea of what your credit is? Okay, we're going to look at all three bureaus and take the middle of those three. But now, because of the cost of credit and because we don't want to start off on a hard pull, I just pull a mortgage soft pull that'll give me two bureaus, and it doesn't even show up as an inquiry. And then I can get them some itemized numbers and a pretty good fee sheet to give them an idea of where we're at. And then if they go under contract or get serious, then we'll pull the hard pull. So the first thing is I ask potential buyers, hey, do you have an idea of what your score is? And if somebody says, like say it's less than 660, they think it's in the fives or in the low 600s, then I would almost naturally assume they're going to do an FHA loan, either an FHA loan, or if they're a veteran, a VA, or if they're in a certain area, a USDA loan, probably a Govy loan. right? If they say, hey, I'm in the 700s, then we'll look at all options. We'll look at conventional and FHA, okay? And see which one's best for them. But really, I tell people, and I don't want to take over the questions here, but three buckets real quick, three things. So credit score, I need at least a 580 to get you an approval, okay? Or at least run it through the system. Number one is credit score. Bucket number two, and the most important, is your debt to income ratio. So you take your total consumer debt, like whatever shows up on your credit report, credit card, student loans, car payments, any kind of consumer debt, plus your new housing payment proposed. So I'll just give them if they say we're looking in the 400 price point range, I'll have a general idea of what the monthly P&I would be. I'll estimate insurance, estimate taxes. So I'll get their total debt, that new housing payment plus the consumer debt divided by their income. Okay. And that if it's W-2, it's straightforward. It's what your W-2 is. If it's self-employed, this is where everybody gets tied up. It's a two-year average of line 31 on your Schedule Cs. You take all that in consideration, you come up with the ratio. But a great rule of thumb, if somebody's an agent, and you really don't want to be an agent, you don't want to be a loan officer and get in too much detail because you're trying to sell the house. But if you can somehow get around, hey, ballpark, if you know what their income is, so if they say they make $60,000 a year, you kind of know it's about $5,000 a month. And just off the top of your head, you know half of that, which in this case would be $2,500, is a total amount of debt they can have out. So if somebody says I have two houses and three cars and I'm trying to buy 500, but I make 60,000 a year, you probably know the ratios are not going to work. First thing is credit. Second thing is debt to income. And then third is where the money's coming from. Is it you're getting gift funds or you're getting DPA funds or you're borrowing that money or, you know, there's different things. So we got to document that. So we document your credit score. We document your income, your debt to income. And then we document and source where the money to buy the house is coming from. And that's it. That's it in a nutshell right there.
Well, no, thank you for explaining that to us. So that actually led us into a couple of questions. My first question would be, so if somebody comes to you and they find out their debt to income ratio is too high. So is all hope lost forever? Or is there something that, you know, you can do to help them eventually become a homeowner or get on the path to homeownership?
Yeah, you're on the right. I mean, you're thinking like a loan officer. So if their DTI is too high, people don't know this. Like I could go off and say they have money either through gift funds or they just have cash saved up. We can pay off debt to help them qualify for the new purchase. So if we make it to be paid off, to be paid, it's just going to increase their cash to close. So say there's a credit card and there's $20,000 and that $20,000 is $800 a month, right? Right now I'm having to count that $800 a month. But if they had the extra cash, I would just include that to be paid off as a debt. And now I don't have to count that 800 against their ratios. So one thing you can do is see where they are with available cash and pay off debt to help qualify. Another thing you do is if they're thinking, hey, I'll just go and buy myself, right? But their DTI doesn't work. Then is there anybody else we can add to the loan? Can we add a spouse or we can add a parent? We can even add a non-owner occupant. They don't even have to be living in that home. We just count the new debt, the new credit score, and use them on the loan to help us qualify.
So that's awesome, Tim. That's really good for our listeners to know. So even if, you know, they think, oh, that's bad news, I don't qualify, all hope isn't lost. There's still things and ways to kind of, you know, maneuver the situation.
Debt to income is overcomable. Not high enough credits, hey, I'm in the 400s. That's not a road stop either. It just may delay the process. We'll have to do some credit repair. We'll have to try to get our credit cards 50% of the available balance, and we'll have to see if there's anything in dispute. We'll have to go and get that. If it's credit is the reason we're not getting an approved eligible, it may take a little bit of time, but it can still be done. There's really nothing that can stop you from buying a house. If your mindset is you want to do it and it's a priority, you work with a good loan officer, we can help navigate the process.
And that's awesome. And so that's the key, is just to make sure you're working with somebody who's looking out for your best interests and is there to guide you along the way, like Tim at Mortgage Core.
A little commercial there. I like that.
How has the industry either kept up or not kept up with the new ways of making money? Now with the age of like TikTok and going live, people are making large amounts of cash and they'll go from like having nothing to having enough money to buy a house, but they don't really have a form of showing earned income other than like live streaming something. So how does that play in effect to buying a house?
Yeah, they, I don't know that they've done a great job there. I think they're a little bit behind. I think there's going to be, have to be some more changes made. Fannie, Freddie, the agencies, they move a little slow. And you're right. I think, what's that term? They call it gig economy. So there's so many people out as Lyft drivers or Uber driver, or just, you know, different ways of making money that may not be your normal punch a clock and get a pay stub. So I actually think the agencies will need to come out. If you go non-QM, do bank statement loans, do DSCR loans, do some of these other loan program or investors, they seem to be a little bit better in that aspect. But here's a good thing for your listeners to know too. Really, there's three avenues. There's agency, right? That's going to be Fannie, Freddie, FHA, USDA, and VA. I mean, that's your agency loan. They're going to be the hardest to get, right? But they're going to give you the best rates, the best terms, the best rates. They're a little bit more restrictive, but they're also covering their risk by making sure that they have a good loan that's going to perform and not default. Then the next group of loans is really, you'll hear non-QM or Alt-A, used to be the old subprime loans. These are anything that doesn't use traditional W-2 pay stubs, you know, tax returns to qualify your income. These are like bank statement loans, DSCR loans, interest-only loans, jumbo loans. All that's considered non-QM. That's going to be your next move after agency, and it's going to be a little bit higher rates. It's going to be higher rates, usually a longer term. So these are private held investors that are giving you the money, and they're kind of almost portfolioing it or holding the paper and selling. In some cases, they sell to agencies, but usually they're holding that paper. So they make their own guidelines. But they're in the business to make money, too. They're not. They don't want loans that are going to default. Now, a lot of people think, hey, well, what do you care if I don't make my payment? You'd have my house. You can just sell that. Well, first of all, banks aren't into business to sell homes. They don't want to do that. They're not set up for that. They want you to make your monthly payment. And then the third avenue, so first avenue would be any of your agency loans, then you have the non-QM investors, and then you hear the term hard money. Hard money is more like, hey, you don't have any income, and really you're hard to document, so we're going to charge you 10 or 11%, and we're going to make the term much shorter. So there's really a home for all three, anybody, but as you move down the line, there are higher rates. So what I try to do is, can you qualify for the best rates? Can't qualify for the best rates. Can we look at non-QM? Can't do non-QM, then we're going to have to look at hard money. So that's the kind of good thing to know. I think a lot of people get confused on the agents about the different loan types. Thought I'd throw that out there.
No, that's good. That's really good information. And I hope everybody's taking notes because it's really good information to have, especially with the way everything is changing from the way people are making money to the way they're, you know, spending money. And when people who aren't making money traditionally, and then they're Uber drivers, or, you know, they are streaming or something like that, and then you have tips involved, where do they stand along the lines of like claiming the money that they're making? Should they claim everything? Should they not claim everything? The tips, like, how does that work for them when they're trying to buy a house?
Well, when you're trying to buy a house, you're best to claim everything. I mean, you really want to be able to document it, whether it's some way of documenting. If you get W-2s, especially the year you're going to buy, go out, you're about to buy a house, you want to have the foresight, even a couple of years in advance. Maybe I put more on my tax returns and I write off a little bit less, so my net income is higher, because that's what we're going to use to qualify you on your amount, right? I know as a self-employed owner, I'm self-employed, that you're encouraged to write off a lot, but the year you're trying to buy a house, if you're going to be on the loan, you might want to rethink that a little bit. So, but that's it. I mean, if you're W-2, we're looking at pay stubs. If you're highly commissioned and you get a lot of tips, or you're 100% commission, or you're self-employed, or you have a K-1 or whatever, then we're looking at using tax returns. And that's where it gets to be a little bit of an issue. That's where most people don't get. They don't get, hey, I made $100,000, but you told Uncle Sam it cost you from your expenses $60,000. So I can only use 40K, you know, or say approximately, you know, almost 4,000 a month to help you qualify. And the worst part is not just 1 year, it's a 2-year average on most cases.
Gotcha.
So, fear about it.
Would you say that if you're wanting, you know, to buy a house in the next couple of years, it would be a good idea just to talk to a lender now, even if, you know, you're not quite ready, but that way you can kind of get your ducks in a row and get things organized?
Definitely. Definitely. And I love that you would say that, because that's kind of the way I view myself. I'm not just a order taker or here's the rates. I want to help. I want to consult people. I think I'm almost a financial or mortgage consultant that can help you get in position to buy a home. So I think that might be one of my biggest, it's not really a pet peeve, but people don't understand. I'll get calls, Heather, once a day almost. And they're like, okay, well, what's the rates today? And I think we've had this conversation. I'm like, well, what do you want the rates to be? They can be anything you want them to be. If you're willing to buy points and buy the rates down, I can make the points 2%. I can make them anything you want it to be. You, Tony and yourself, you guys get it. Y'all get it. You're great to work with. But a lot of agents, like, they don't get that, or really mostly first-time home buyers or buyers, that they don't get the whole process of what we use to qualify somebody. So I have to educate.
I think everybody gets hung up on the rate. Everybody's always like, oh, the interest rate. And I never understood why. To me, it was always the price of the house, because you can't change the price of the house after you buy the house.
Exactly.
And for some reason, people are more concerned with the interest rate than the price of the house.
You know what's crazy about that too, Heather, is I never understood that, because the difference, say you're buying a $400,000 home, right? And you were like, I got to get the best rate, or my rates are, you say you're at 7, right? Which is, on a conventional loan, you're probably about 7.25 today, maybe a little bit higher. The difference between 7 and say 6.875 on a $400,000 loan, maybe $50 or $60 a month. It's not that much. It's not enough to be like, I mean, I'm bigger about it. If that's your big thing, try to negotiate seller concessions and buy the rate down. Just get a lower rate to start with.
So I guess, would that be one thing that you wish more agents knew?
What I wish more agents, I think the biggest thing I wish about agents is they think somehow we're associated with the appraisal. I have nothing to do with the appraisal. We order it from an appraisal company. An appraiser has a lot of training. They have to go through 3 years of apprenticeship before they even become an appraiser. Most of the ones that have been in the business, but a lot of times I'll get upset. Hey, this house didn't appraise. You don't know what you're doing. This house didn't appraise. I'm like, all I did was order the appraisal. I don't set the value. So I think that's a misconception, is that somehow the lender has something to do with the appraisal. It doesn't. We're just ordering it. And if it comes back at what the appraiser thinks versus what the listing agent thinks, maybe the listing agent is wrong. Maybe the listing agent put it at that price because they wanted a higher amount. So I don't know. I always have a struggle with that, because I really think I have a lot of bosses. I'm the buyer, the buyer's agent, the listing agent. I have a lot of people I have to answer to. I mean, they're just going off of comps and other stuff to come up with a value. But that's a little bit of a pet peeve about real estate agents, especially listing agents, that get all upset if it doesn't appraise.
I didn't realize that they blamed you when something didn't appraise.
I blame the lender a lot on a lot of things, but that, yes, that's one of them. Like, I knew we should have went with our lender. My values always come in. I'm like, well, I have nothing to do with the appraiser. So yeah, I get blamed for that a fair amount. But it's okay. I'm thick skinned.
So there are a lot of factors in play, but I guess nobody wants to be at fault. So it's got to be somebody's fault and not theirs.
Well, plus I think it moves, you know, maybe agents are still thinking 3 months ago or 2 months ago, and now new data's came in that the appraiser's using, and that does affect the value. I mean, it can move quickly. You know, a neighborhood, if one or two go lower, especially on the same street or nearby, that can affect the value pretty quickly.
Okay, Tim. So let's talk about down payment assistance and the pros and the cons for home buyers.
Okay, DPA, you'll hear that term, down payment assistance, is really hot right now. It's tough to save money to buy a house. So there is some true 100% loan programs. Like, if you're a veteran, it's probably the best loan out there, any kind of VA loan. If you're a veteran, utilize your VA benefits to purchase a house. I will say, even on that, there's some requirements. And it only goes for 100% of the loan. You still have your closing costs. So if you can get a VA loan, 100% down payment or 100% loan, and then work with somebody who's good at it, like you guys are, to get the seller to pay some concessions, because you can get up to 4% on a VA loan, seller concessions, that is the best loan going. 100% loan, very low rates, and then get the seller to pay for some of the closing costs. That's number one.
There is a ton of down payment assistance loans out there. The bigger loan programs like Georgia Dream, there's a lot of city and county initiatives. There's one in Columbus, Georgia that's real good. There used to be a Gwinnett initiative. There's tons of them, and I don't by no means know them all. Problem with those is like they fund them for a year, and you're probably hot and heavy over this program, and then they'll go away, right? Because they run out of money, and then they have to wait, or maybe it was only meant to be a year. It's supposed to, you know, it's some extra surplus money that a government agency has, in most cases, that issues out, okay? But there's also banks now getting into the space and other investors that are issuing down payment assistance, okay? So is it good for the borrowers? In my opinion, no. Now, I don't want to be a straight hard no. It's not going to give you the best rate. I don't care what people say. So if you can qualify for 3.5%, say you're doing an FHA loan, your scores are, if somehow you can get your family to give you gift funds for that 3.5%, you get the seller to contribute to your closing costs, the best rate you can get is just a normal FHA loan outside of VA. It's just a normal. You get somebody to help you with the 3.5%. Even if it's like, say I'm buying a $300,000 home, and 3.5%, well, like $7,500, right? Down payment. You can get the, say I have $2,000, you get somebody else to help you with the other, okay? So that is gonna give you the lowest rate, okay? But there, say that's not possible. You don't have any family, they don't have any money, you want the house. There is some DPA loans that are better than others. There's some loan and investors that, you know, we'll do it as a true down payment assistance. But you got to be careful. Every one of these down payment assistance are a little bit different. Some of them are a grant. Some of them are repayable. Some are non-repayable. You got to, you know, some of them don't just come off unless you've made your payment for 4 or 5 years. So all these different empowers and some of these big banks have their own ones. Pros and cons, and you just have to know that investor. So you have to work with your loan officer and say, hey, I don't have the 3.5. I can't get it. I need to go this down payment. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, your rates will be higher. They will be slightly higher. And then you just go through and look at the different ones and make sure that the criteria that that investor has for their down payment assistance meets this buyer. And you tell them the pros and cons and say, hey, here it is. You know, you could have got a rate. If you can come up with 3.5, your rate is 6.25. If you want to go this down payment assistance, because you're not putting any skin in the game, you're borrowing 100%, your rate may be 7.5. And they're going to charge you a point to get it, or 0.5. So really, if they're charging you 1.5 and they're only giving you 3.5, you really only picked up 1.5. So for 1.5, you're getting a point more in interest rate? No, in that case, I'm like, sure, let's retract every way you can get more money. Do you have a 401k? Do you have even a little 401k that you can take out money? Now you can take it out as a loan, so you don't even have to count that in your debt to income calculation, that 401k. Used to, you have to, but not anymore. Now that they consider it a loan, they don't even count that because it's your money. You're just getting a loan to yourself. I'm probably a little bit different. A lot of people get on here and spout how great DPA is because they know that gets the phones ringing. I'm like, hey, that's not my first go-to. My first go-to is, can you come up with the money? If you can't, then yeah, we'll look at DPA.
Do you think that a lot of the advertising for down payment assistance is a little bit of clickbait, like you were saying, just to get the phone ringing, and then it turns out the people don't actually qualify and they can't get the funding?
I think so, yeah. Now, I don't want to be like somebody calling me and saying, well, you don't know our program. Our program is this. So I don't know all the programs. So there could be some good examples, and I will help everybody search. But I start off with, here's your best loan program on an agency or whatever, and then we'll go to DPA. But, you know, what also people don't understand is the down payment is just one aspect. You still have to get the FHA loan. So it does nothing to do with credit qualifying you for a loan, and it does nothing to do with your debt to income. You're still qualifying with a regular traditional or FHA loan. Then you're getting help with the DPA. That's all about where the money is. That's that third bucket where your money's coming from. So a lot of people also think, first-time home buyers, hey, I've got a, you know, I'm just going to be a little silly here, but I got a 400 credit. I'll just use DPA and that'll take care of everything. That's just not how it works. You still got to qualify for the first loan, the 96.5. And then we will help you if you have no other avenues to get the money. I'll help you investigate other down payment programs that can help you come up with that.
It's funny you're saying that. I know one thing that I hear from clients a lot was, like, I would send them the link about your mortgage application, and they would be like, why do they need all this information? Why do I have to fill out these forms? Why do I have to give them all of my history and, you know, all of my taxes, my W-2s, my employment information? And I'm like, dude, they're going to be giving you hundreds of thousands of dollars. You have to show that you have the money to pay this back. Do you run into that a lot?
I try to be considerate because they're, you know, I just say, listen, if you're about to give somebody $400,000, are you going to make sure that they're going to repay you back? Are there a good risk? It all comes down to risk. So banks are saying, I have this amount of money, millions and millions of dollars. I'm going to loan it to this guy. Am I going to get a return on that investment? Is that person a good risk? Am I going to loan this money and in 3 weeks or 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, whatever, they're going to default. And then we're just holding this loan that we've already given out money on. We're going to have to sell it less. Rates could be higher now. So they're all about analyzing risk. And unfortunately, the system could use some revamping. But the way they've decided to evaluate that individual risk is credit score, debt to income, and where's your money coming from? Is it your own funds or is it DPA? That's another thing people don't understand is if you go down payment assistance, I have to put that in the system as down payment assistance, run it through automated approval engine to determine whether you can get the loan. That is a riskier file if you have no skin in the game versus if it's your, you know, if it's your own funds, you're pulling from your savings, you're pulling from your 401k, it's not as risky. But if I have zero, then really where is your commitment to make sure that you pay your mortgage payment before you go buy new clothes or new tennis shoes? Because they want to make sure you're a good risk. It's all about calculating and analyzing risk.
Because like you said earlier, the banks don't want to take the house away. They're not in the business of, you know.
They lose money when they default. They have to go through proceeding. That's not what they're in business for. They're not real estate agents. They don't want your house.
And speaking of like buying new shoes, buying new things, when you're in the process of buying a house, I know this is something I always very clear with buyers. When you're in the process, you're, you know, getting everything worked out so that you can be at that closing table. Why shouldn't people go buy furniture on financing for that house? Why shouldn't they buy a car? Why shouldn't they sign a student loan for their niece or something like that? Why do they need to not do anything on their credit during the process?
Yeah, I get calls in the middle of a loan process and they're like, hey, I'm about to go on vacation. Is that okay? And I'm like, you know, I don't know how much is the vacation going to cost you and whatnot. It all goes back to debt to income. Until you actually sign the papers, they're making sure you didn't lose your debt to income. So if I pull credit and a credit's good for 90 days and it's this amount of debt on there, right? So that's your debt. We're going to divide that by your income and we know you're good. But if you go buy a new car and all of a sudden you have another $800 payment, I got to count that in the new debt. So that's why people are like, hey, don't go be buying a lot of stuff and opening up new lines of credit because they're going to check it. 7 days prior to closing, we do another credit, basically soft pull. We look and make sure no new lines were opened. Because if there was, we've got to get documentation of what the balance is, because it's going to increase your debt to income ratio. It's all about DTI. Debt to income is the most important, really qualifying factor. Credit score is what it is, but there's so many moving parts with your debt to income ratio. That's what really, I think, banks use as the biggest tool to determine whether buyer A is a good buyer, whether we should give them this money or not.
So plan that vacation around the closing to be after the closing, the furniture after the closing.
Right.
So tell little Susie she can't go to college yet.
Yeah. Don't lose your job. And if you do lose your job, people, that's another thing. We've had people that were ready to close. I think one of Tony's, we had ready to close a loan, right? And they do a verification of employment 7 days prior to closing too, anywhere from 0 to 7 days. And we've called them, or, you know, processors have called, and they no longer work there. No longer work there. So then we call them and, hey man, we just tried to do a VOE on you. What happened? Oh yeah, I left that job. I got another one. I'm like, well, why didn't you tell me? So, you know, we're all at the closing table. We're getting ready to go to the closing table. Oh, I thought it would mess things up. It's always better just to come up, tell your loan officer what's going on. Because we can move on the fly pretty quickly. We can then go and say, you got a new job, get me a new pay stub, get me new everything. Let me get that back in front of underwriting. And it, 9 times out of 10 works. Now, if I qualified you making you know, $120,000 a year and you're only making $60,000, then we have to rerun the debt to income and it may not work.
Can you kind of elaborate and break down for us the rules and regulations when it comes to the years you have to have in a certain job and the related industry and how that works? Because I know we've run into that a couple times too, where somebody quit their job and then got a totally different field.
So the main thing is if you're going to W-2, it's pretty straightforward if you're in the same line of work, right? So if you were, an accountant working for an accounting firm, you went to another accounting, worked for another accounting firm, and we got an offer letter or we got a new pay stub, that makes pretty good. And as long as there's no large gap, right? But if you were a school teacher, right, and then you went to become a fire person that was highly commissioned, or you were, you know, something that was, well, that can be problematic because you haven't enough time in your new job, in your new field, especially if you're highly commissioned, to determine what your true income is going to be. If it's W-2 to W-2, and even if it's not the same field, but we can say you were an office manager here, or you're an admin person here, or an HR person, and you're an HR person here, we'll make it work. But it's when you change the whole field, what you're doing, and really if you go from W-2 to either highly bonused, definitely if you go to self-employed, people do that. That's the worst thing you can do. Go to a good W-2 job, say, I'm going to go become my own boss and be self-employed and then try to go get the loan. You would better be sick with W-2 until after you buy the house. Yeah, that's a thing that happens a lot. People don't get the difference between, I've got to look at 2 years of W-2.
So 2 years W-2.
I'm sorry, 2 years of tax returns.
Tax return.
I only need to look at, on W-2, I just need to look at the pay stubs.
Okay, so just a pay stub. But preferably same field, same type of stuff. Don't do crazy job changes.
Yeah. And even maybe have a reason why I left. Even like I got a better job or something like that. So that's not a deal breaker. Going from W-2 to self-employed usually is a deal breaker because you don't have 2 years set up in that new job or new business. A lot of people don't get to, they think 1099 is the same as W-2. 1099 is self-employed. You are 1099. You're a contractor that works primarily for this one company or one person, and they give you a 1099. But you're still self-employed. You pay your own taxes. That's another thing. A lot of people think 1099 is, what I made $100,000. They gave you $100,000. Then you had to tell Uncle Sam you wrote off $50,000. So that kind of comes back to that.
That's kind of what we were talking about earlier, about making sure that if you are self-employed, if you're claiming everything and you're not just everything off.
Make that. Another thing is offer letters. They've kind of cracked down on that. They were getting really, agencies were getting pretty laxed on it, but they've been a crackdown as a reason. It needs to spell it out. You need to be a salary employee. You know, like I would get, hey, I just started this new job. They didn't qualify before. They said they make, say, $3,000 a month, right? And then they go get a job, right? And they say, here's my offer letter. And the offer letter is $7,000, almost like a 100% increase, right? Or more. But I'm going to be hourly, and the offer letter doesn't spell out the terms and condition, and it's contingent on this. That's not going to fly anymore with agencies. They're going to want you to show a clear, I'm a salaried employee, here's the offer letter, it spells out every terms, there's no contingencies, and then that may work. But some of the offer letters in the past that help people get qualified are being looked at a little bit more harshly now.
Gotcha. Can you break down for us on an FHA loan, just kind of like roughly credit score and then down payment and the requirements for those? And I know it's a lot.
We do a lot of FHA loans. I mean, I'm a big fan of FHA loans. I think they perform just as well as conventional. They get a bad rap. They get a bad rap with agents. That's a no. I should have went back and said that on my pet peeve, is that VA and FHA, a lot of agents kind of turn their nose at those because they think they're being scrutinized on the appraisal. But I think they need to kind of change that attitude a little bit and allow, because they're missing out on a segment of people that could purchase a home. But yeah, so anything from 580 or greater will work with an FHA. Okay. Should work. That doesn't mean you're going to approve eligible, but less than 580, I can't even run it through the system. So from a credit standpoint on an FHA loan, I need at least a 580. Debt to income, that's a good thing with FHA. You can go up to 55%, 56% maybe. But usually the max is about 55% DTI, right? So it allows for a higher debt-to-income ratio. That's a good thing. Another good thing is on student loans. They're only going to count. That's another thing people don't get on student loans, on FHA. Regardless if it's in deferment, I'm going to look at the balance and use a half of a percent of that balance to count against your debt load. Whereas on Fannie, they're going to use a percent, 1%. So a little bit more forgiving on FHA with student loans. 580 credit, probably in that 55 max range on ratios. It's a possibility if you had enough reserves, you could maybe bump it up a little bit higher. Yeah, and you just, if you have those, I can run it and then see where we're at. It may be that 55 is too much, they don't like it, or they we may need additional reserves. Reserves help a lot. So if you're having trouble getting a loan, and I would educate or talk to your loan officer and say, hey, why don't you see if I put $10,000 in reserves that I have that, can I get an approved eligible? And sometimes they don't even ask for those reserves. Just adding it into the application will help you get an approved eligible. FHA likes reserves on low credit scores, high ratios. And that's pretty much it. And then where the money's coming from, where that 3.5, we go back to that. You know, I've got a document. I'm going to get 60 days. Oh, here's another thing. 60 days of bank statements, all right? So I'm going to get 60 days of bank statement. I have to source any large deposit. I think we're at 99, if that makes a difference. Does it? Are we good?
It says 99.
Yeah, but I'm going to ask for 60 days of bank statement. So if there's a large, you know, deposit that you can't source, say you won gambling or somebody just gave you cash, right, and you can't source it, then you can, what they call, and I got to be careful because I'm online, but you can season that. I'm only going to ask for 60 days, but if you put that money in 90 days ago and then send me 60 days of bank statements, I would not see that. So when you're starting to buy a home, always be on the foresight. Okay, this year I'm going to buy a home. Here, what do I need to do to get myself in position? So there's a lot of little nuances that I have learned over 25 years that I love to share with people. Work with a good loan officer. There's a lot of them out there. There's a lot of not good ones too.
Well, just like real estate agents and professionals in every industry, there's good ones and there's bad ones. And you got to be careful who you work with, who you pick to associate with in your day-to-day life. Where do you see the market headed?
So with rates, here's what I see. If you've been following some of the economic indicators and economic news, we've moved over from the first time in, I think, last 4 years, we've kind of switched from a seller's market to a buyer's market. There's the first time that the inventory, basically, there's more homes on the market they've been in the last 5 years. So the inventory is coming back online, right? The only thing we need to do now is get confidence in the economy and that we're not going to create inflation and get the rates down. I would love to see the rates on a conventional loan, you know, maybe mid sixes, and in the FHA, low sixes, high fives. If we can get that sweet spot with inventory coming back online, and then the rates in that low sixes, mid sixes, that would be a sweet spot. I think everyone would start jumping and saying, okay, this is where we're going to get. Problem is we've had no inventory and then no rates. Now we're getting a little bit of inventory, but high rates. So if we can work those two things can work together, I think we're in a spot to see huge boom for real estate agents and for loan officers. I do think in certain pockets of the country, you already look what's happening in Florida, we're having a housing bubble. I think in 2008, when we had our big last crisis, it's the same thing. Florida was kind of a flagship for what was eventually going to happen across the country. But right now, price points are really dropping in Florida. So I hope that's just an isolated area. Hope it doesn't transcend to the rest of the country. I don't know that it will. I just think people are still a little uncertain about the indicators with the economy and the tariffs and how that all is going to impact the mortgage-backed securities. But everything I read and see right now, it's moving in the right direction. We got some good news today. Rates improved a little bit. But I will say this. You don't have the luxury anymore to wait. Okay, rates are now at, you know, they came down a quarter. Or they came down half a point. I'll wait till they come down a point because you could be waiting a while. You see a little bit of movement, you need to jump on it. Because it could go the other way too. No one knows with 100% certainty. I'm bullish. I think that the market's going to rebound. Whether we're going to rebound where we have this huge cash refinance boom, I'm not sure. But for the people that are on the sideline to purchase, I think we are going to have a little bit of better time. Maybe rocky up and down the next 3, but starting in the fall and then the beginning of 2026, I think the factors are going to come together where it's going to be positive. I'm a pro right now. I'm upbeat.
I do know from the real estate side of things, and I know you can never really, you can't predict the market. You never know what's going to happen. But from what I've seen in the past is when the rates do come down, the prices go up. And I was there when it was, I remember one time Tony and I went to a showing and we were working with a client who wasn't even using a loan. He was cash. And we offered $70,000 over asking price in cash and didn't get the house.
Well, certain pockets are always going to be that way, but that's because there's no inventory. I mean, if you think about it, what was it? You know, COVID, there was 3 years we didn't build one home. We didn't have any lumber. We basically put building on, and we were already low in inventory. The new home starts real low. But in the last 3 years, we've been getting back up. So that whole philosophy about, if rates get lower, price points are going to go up. That works when there's no inventory, but when you have supply and demand and you can't charge that higher rate, somebody will just go to another house, then you have the perfect mix between lower rates and inventory. They can't play that game where I'm just going to go up on price points.
Can you explain refinancing for people who don't know what that is?
Yeah, so refinancing is just paying off the existing mortgage to either get a lower rate or get your equity out of the house. So what most people don't know about refinances is we're going to get a new appraisal, okay? And we're the max, if you want to get equity out of your house, people think they can get 100% equity out of their house. Now, the rule is the most you can get is 80% of the new appraised value, okay? So if you bought the house for, I'm just using some numbers here, $300,000 5 years ago, and now you think it's $600,000, right? Well, then we're going to take 80% of that $600,000, right? So what is that, 40? 600 times a 0.80 times a 0.80 is 480,000, right? So the most you can get is that 480,000, 80% of the new appraised value. So say you got 480, you've been in the home for about a year or so, and your balance is now, say, 275. So in that scenario, you have $205,000 in equity you can pull out for whatever reason you want. So now we have a new loan for 480. We paid off the existing loan, and the difference is the cash you can pull out and get in the form of money, cash in hand. But say you don't want equity, you just want to lower your rate. So then we take a look at the same process. We look at the appraised value, the minus your balance, okay? And then that is your new loan amount, whatever you need it to be. And then we just do a rate and term. Rates on a rate and term are going to be lower than they are in a cash out refi. Problem right now is, there's a ton of equity. Everybody has equity in their home right now. And there also is a ton of debt. Credit card debt is at an all-time high. So people are so tough, or that they don't know, like, I got a 3% rate. Why would I mess with my 3% rate? Well, they're really being a little short-sighted, because then they say, well, yeah, but you also got $60,000 of debt at 20% that you're paying. It would be much smarter to grab some of that debt, even if it's 6%, and pay it off. And pay off all that credit card debt, then it's going to be a lower monthly payment and help you get out. People are struggling themselves with all this debt because they want to hold on to the 3% rate. That's why HELOCs are so popular right now. It's because people are keeping their 3% rate but go get in a line of credit. Line of credits are good to a degree. I wouldn't put a lot on a line of credit because it's just like a credit card. It's month to month. So if the index changes or the market changes for the worse, then that month your commitment on the HELOC is going to go way up.
So somebody who isn't even wanting to necessarily buy another house, they're just kind of wanting to change their overall financial position, they can call you and talk to you about doing a refinance to see
if that works. I learned the business. Yeah, I was one of the first lenders on LendingTree Network back 20 years ago. And that's when rates were going down every day. But yeah, I do. I love refis. I do a lot of refis. And there's so much you can do with refis. We can say, why don't we pay off these four debts? And then you can save a little bit of money, put it aside, do some repairs. So it's like a puzzle, too. You just look at your whole financial picture, figure out what debts you want to pay off, how much equity is in the home. The closing costs on a refinance are going to be less than they are on a purchase. You're not going to have like owner's title. That's just reissued. You're not going to have some of the other closing costs associated with a purchase. And that's rolled into the loan. So if you owed, say you're going to do a loan amount for $400 and you want your loan amount to include your closing costs, we just put all that in there. So it's not like you have to have any money to come to closing with. You're just pulling equity out.
Is there anybody that you would say that they shouldn't do a refinance?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on your situation. Every situation is different. If you're at a 3% or 4% and, you know, you don't really need the money, you don't have to pay off debt, you don't have a lot of debt, then you should just keep your rate. There's no reason to go from a 4 to a 6.5 unless there's some benefit to you, a net tangible benefit. And most of those loan programs won't allow you to do that. There has to be a net tangible. You have to be paying off debt. You have to be reducing your rate. There has to be some reason. Most investors, per Fannie guidelines, are not going to allow you to.
And so whether it's refinancing or getting your home loan, what areas do you service, Tim? Is it just Georgia? Do you work in other states?
Thank you for doing that. I thought we were still just trying to learn about it. You're helping me out trying to get business. Aren't you sweet? No, we're right now in Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and Pennsylvania. And I've been saying this for about a year, so I got to either do it or quit saying it, but soon to be Texas. So yeah, I'm trying to get in as many states as possible.
That would be awesome. So anybody in any of those states can contact you through your website and put in an application?
www.mortgagecore.com or call Tim Arrington. Maybe, can I give my phone number?
Yep, go ahead, give your phone number. And I'm also going to attach the link to the podcast and in the notes so that if they want to apply, they can just go on your website. But yes, give us your phone number, please.
Yeah, so my number is 770-856-6397. And the name of the company is Mortgage Core. Just go to my website or you can call me directly. I can answer any questions you may have. If you have any buyers that have questions, I'm big on trying to help people, very big on reviews. If you go to Google and look at Mortgage Core, you can look at our reviews. You can see the type of business we do. I try to shoot straight with people. And, you know, we really take a lot of pride in our customer service and trying to deliver the best we can.
You guys really do. And I can speak from experience. I have lots of clients who have been very happy with Mortgage Core. You, Amanda, we love you guys. We just barely scratched the surface, but we got a lot of good gems today. But I would love to have you back and really dive deeper into certain areas because I feel like we could just talk forever. There's so much to cover when it comes to mortgages. I really like to go over the start to finish process of the whole loan when we have time to do that. I want to thank you today for being on here. And again, just encourage everybody to reach out to Tim if you have any financial needs. You can either click the link or shoot Tim a text or a phone call. Any last parting words, Tim, you have for everybody?
Well, I appreciate you having me as a guest. I mean, I think I'm a big fan of yours. So you do a great job. And we kind of work similar where we communicate well. I would say this, just if you're thinking about needing a good loan officer and a good mortgage company in any of those states, please give me a call. I was an in-house lender for a realtor company for many years. So I kind of get what agents need or want. I mean, the main thing is they want to communicate. They want good news and they want bad news at the same time. They just want to make sure that they're in the loop. And I appreciate that. And I try to deliver those services. But thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here, Tim. And again, this is Heather with Head in the Clouds, and we will see you guys on the next one. Don't forget to go like, subscribe, and follow. Bye, guys.